Let's resume. So we're on to part four of four, so we have a good chance, I'm sure, we will be able to finish that today. And that gives you plenty of time then to think through the ideas as you're doing your implementation. So we're at the very top of the class node. So logically, this will actually be one of the first steps executed. And as you'll see, we'll go ahead and process fields, which we already talked about, and process methods, which we'll talk about. And inside methods, we'll talk about statements. So we set up the current method as null because we're not in the method as yet. And class got set up to the appropriate name that the user specified in the CSX definition. And now we're going to start generating some boilerplate. And boilerplate means it's going to be the same no matter what program you're compiling. And in this case, remember, the dot says this is an indication not to generate code, but rather to Jasmine that some declaration is coming. So dot class public says, please make whatever class name the user chose public. No reason to make it private. This is a simple enough language. And it says, every class has to have a superclass. And here's where we had that problem over the weekend. And it says, Java slash is their way of indicating a dot in the Java notation. So java.lang.object. But it's important that cap O be in there because Java and the systems follow the rules that capital O is not the same as lowercase o. So it's an easy enough error to make, but in this case, it's really nasty. In fact, I kind of meant to do it. I was going to take that Jasmine that was generated, and there's a program available in Unix, and I'm sure there's also in Windows, that counts the number of characters in a file. So even in that small little file, which was maybe 10 or 20 lines, there must have been maybe 50 or 100 characters, perhaps even more. And just like good old programs, one out of 100 of the characters was wrong. And it was only wrong very slightly in terms of being a lowercase o versus a capital O. And that's enough for a program to go nuts. And again, seeing that that occurs, I'm always, as I said earlier, amazed that so many programs work. Because you can do the tiniest little error, and programs will simply say wrong. And usually what they do wrong, they fail. It's not like, you know, mom or dad say, oh, you don't do that again. We'll let you off the hook this time. Or I don't know what happens if you're in the food lines at the cafeteria and you take another helping of tacos or something. You know, you're a thief, or just go ahead and enjoy your tacos and don't do it again. But programs are very harsh, and that's just unfortunate. So at any rate, what we've done here is now we're going to start walking the major structure of a CSX program. Remember, a program at the top level is an identifier which we've used, and it's some fields, and it's some methods. So in this particular case, we're going to go look at the fields in the members decal, and we're going to visit the fields. But here's something odd. Look at this guy and look down several lines lower. We're going to visit this guy not once, but twice. It's not usual, but sometimes we need to visit a structure twice. In this case, we're visiting the fields twice for the very strange reason, or at least strange until you understand what compiling is doing, is that if we have a field, just change over here. I can go ahead and have a field like int f equals 1. That's fine. And int g equals f plus 1. And again, sometimes what happens is you'll have a constant field or initialized field that sets some parameter, and then you might have other parameters which are based on the original parameter. So you might want something that's n plus 1 or n minus 1. Or if you have the value of n, you want to have n squared. Because if you have a row of size n, the number of cells you have in a grid is n squared. So little things like that. But from our point of view as compiler writers, we have the problem as follows. Int g is a declaration of a field. The way rule goes is fields are declared before methods. But, this is an expression. Expression is code, and code does not go in fields, except in the trivial case where you have an initialization of 0 or 1. There's no way inside of a field to compute. You cannot compute outside of a method. So what we have to do is put the initialization, which is code, inside of a method. So that's basically why we have those two visits. For this easier field, we could get by with one. That can go entirely in the area where we declare fields. But in this case of the circled elements, we have to do that field in two steps. One is we declare a field named G, but we defer its initialization until we get to a spot inside code, that is inside of a method, where I can do a computation of F plus 1. And because of that, we do two passes, one for the declaration and the other for any non-trivial initialization. So understanding what the motivation is, at least, this first visit is going to go to fields and declare them. We've actually talked about that. That was all the way back on assignment number one, where you get the name of the field, extract it, put a dollar sign on the end to make sure the field name does not clash accidentally with an opcode, and then do any trivial initialization. What I'll then do is, having generated fields, all that remains are methods. So I have to have the method main to start my execution. I may have some other methods that the user declared. And I also have to have this odd-looking method that can't possibly exist in CSX, but acts as a bridge between the Java world and the CSX world. And the reason it can't possibly exist, if we look at it, it says, I'm going to declare a method. It's going to be public, static. And notice the signature uses something that we don't have in CSX, namely string variables or string parameters. So this crazy thing here inside the parentheses is the name of a path through a series of packages to a pre-declared class. And the way this works, and I'm not sure why they chose what they did, is L acts as a left quote, and the semicolon all the way at the end acts as a right quote, and the slashes act as dots. So what this thing is saying is, I'm going to have a static main, and it's going to have an array. Remember, this left bracket means array of. I forgot to change it back, sorry. I can see it, but you can't. It should be the other way around. So in this particular case, as I was saying, L acts as a quote. So it says, I'm an array of something that's java.lang.string. If you look up the documentation, that's where the standard Java string, the one that all programs use, is. And this is what the Java runtime system expects Java programs to start executing. So we're saying we don't have it, but we're going to put it in for the sake of Java, because it's got to find that, or otherwise execution won't work properly. This V, by the way, at the end stands for void. That's the return type. So in this particular case, I'm declaring the method that Java, not CSX, but Java mandates has to be there. So what am I going to do inside this? Well, in this particular case, I'm going to revisit the methods, the fields, because now I'm inside of a method. I'm inside the method that begins first, executes first. And it's going to say, go ahead and revisit those fields and extract any non-trivial initialization you have to do and generate code to do it. So this section down here, if I was going back to my example where G was initialized to F plus 1, it would load F, load 1, do an addition, and store it into field G. And that would have the effect of saying, hey, by the time the CSX program executes, G will be properly initialized. So I got the effect of declaring G and also doing a computation to set its value. It may very well be the case that there are no fields that have that non-trivial initialization, in which case this guy will generate nothing. He'll go through there, say, anybody need some non-trivial initialization? The answer will say no, everything's fine, and nothing will be generated. So returning from that, what we have to say is, I have to go ahead and call the main program that CSX programmers expect begins execution. And that is inside class, whatever, and it's main, takes no parameters, and again, the V at the end says void. How do I know that's going to exist? Because the type checker said one of the rules is, among all the methods user declared, one of them has to be named main, have no parameters, and return void. If it didn't find one of those, the type checker said, hey, there's an error. The standard starting point for CSX is not there. This is an incorrect program. I cannot generate code for it. So assuming that it's passed type checking, we're fine there. It then does a return. So after the CSX main returns, I go back to the Java main. It returns, and then execution is all over with. I initialize the stack depth to 2, and I'm not quite sure why it has to be 2. I would think maybe it could get by with 1, but it can't. Something funny is going on. So 2 is fine. And then end method says I've got done declaring methods. So every CSX program will have a main that the user expected of no parameters and a main that Java expects of an array of strings, which of course never will be used, but it has to be there. If the user called it with parameters, they would be lost. You could do it, but it wouldn't mean anything. And finally, we do where most of the effort is. We go ahead and visit the methods. This will generate code for main and possibly some other methods that the user has declared, but at least main because we know for sure it's there. So this fits nicely on one page, and this is the top level. So you'll probably want to add this in fairly soon if you want to start executing and actually seeing some output. Because here you'll be able to have an execution point, you'll have main called, and inside main you can generate some trivial little statements like doing prints or something, which will allow you to at least get some execution. Once you got that, then you can start adding more and more and actually get some output that you can visually inspect. So let's look at methods. Methods are, well, some of this we have already covered, and that's good because normally I have to explain this from scratch. But many of you, when we were doing type checking, remember we talked about name mangling. And the name mangling I suggested you might consider using in type checking is essentially the same as is used in Java. The only difference is in our name mangling, we did not have to put a return type. But in Java, you can have different overloadings return different types. In our language, if you have two or more overloaded names, they have to return the same type. I did that just for uniformity, but Java is a little bit more general. So this type codes says, whenever we're dealing with a method, either to declare it or to call it, we'll do the mangling that says, here's the name, like here's f of I, that says I take a single integer parameter, I'm named f, and I return an integer. So this is very similar to the name mangling many of you have done. If you haven't, just copied the code. It's pretty straightforward. And the exception is, or the addition is, you have to then add at the end, beyond the right paren, the return code for the type. That's V for void, I for integer, I guess Z for Boolean, and C for char. So here's a little routine that returns the type codes. We've already seen that. And it does this for both a type node and a type. So here's, by the way, I'm using overloading to advantage. Sometimes you have a type node, and sometimes you have a type that's been figured out by the type checker and installed inside of a node. And what happens is we have essentially the same code for each of those, or the same result for each of those. So you can always use type code, and it'll figure out which of these two is the appropriate one to use. I then have a little routine that does a build type code. And again, you may have already programmed something like that. This is the sort of thing that goes ahead and creates a type code for an argument declaration and walks down the arguments and builds the type code sequence. If you don't already have it, just copy this. Otherwise, you can use what you've already coded. Here's a little bit more of that. Here we build a type code for an expression node by checking whether it's an array or not and getting the type codes. And here's the final thing that you'll need to have. This essentially takes the name, puts parens, builds the type codes for the arguments, and then finally, the thing you probably don't have is at the very end, adds in a return code for the return type. So if you already have done mangling, take what you have and just at the end, add that return code. So how do we, in this particular case, translate argument nodes? Well, we essentially just go ahead them and visit them one by one as if they were variables. And we can go ahead and do that in terms of the declaration. How do we do a call? Well, what we do here is we essentially figure out what the type code. Well, first of all, we visit the parameters and push them on the stack. This is just like visiting a series of expressions and they get pushed onto the stack. And you then have to build that type code and generate a call to the class slash the type code of the method you're calling. Function call nodes are very similar. So whatever code you have here for ordinary call nodes, that's at the level of a statement. A function call node will essentially generate the same code. leaving the result of the function on the stack. We have to worry about return nodes because we have to do return statements. There are two kinds of returns. One of them is just a plain return that returns nothing. The other is a function return that says, I go ahead and I'll evaluate the expression being returned, pushing it on the stack, and then generate an I return where it says return a value of type integer. We use that even if you're doing a Boolean or a char. Because remember, we implement Booleans and chars in Java itself as if they were integers. That just makes our code generation easier. So if we have an argument declaration node, what do? We essentially visit those node by node. An argument declaration node essentially says what? It says, I've got to go ahead and say, if I'm a local argument, either a parameter or we'll do the same thing for a local variable, it has to go ahead and say the address information is local. So in this particular case, we're going to set the address information to be a local because it's inside a method. And what we're going to do is, we'll see later, we're going to have to assign slots for each of the local parameters or local variables, but they start at zero. So here's the trick we play. We have a parameter that counts the number of locals. We're going to need to have that when we end up generating the method call, the method declaration itself. That is initialized to zero. And each time we see a local, we grab the current number of locals, use that as the index for the particular frame, and then increment it by one, making the size one bigger. So what happens at the end, if we had five parameters, in this particular case, the parameter numbers would be 0 to 4, and the size would be 5. So in this case, I'm able to use number of locals both as a pointer to the current local index I'm going to allocate and the final count of how many I have when I generate my code. So it looks out pretty simple. And here's the actual method declaration. So we have to set the current method equal to the node we're in. It's no longer null. That means we're in this current method. So we have to have that available. The number of locals, as I said a moment ago, starts out at 0. I have to build a type code for the method. If the arguments are null, it's pretty easy. It's the type code for the method name, and in this particular case, the empty parameters. Otherwise, you get the parameter list, and then we add at the very rightmost end the return type. I then actually start generating some code. I say this is a public static, and I give the type code that I showed you earlier, generate it. I then visit the arguments. This actually goes ahead and allocates slots for them. I then visit the declarations inside the method body, the statements in the method body. I have a slight problem in that I didn't require that at the end of a sequence of statements in a method definition that the user must end with a return. Many will, but they're not guaranteed to. So what I do here is I'm going to add a return at the very end of all the code I generated for statements in case the user forgot to put a return. If the user remembered to put a return in, we'll have two of them. That doesn't matter. The second one won't be used, of course, but it's a protection. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to say, is it the case that my return type is void? In that case, I'm not returning a value, so I just generate a return. That means there's always a return at the very end of the generated code. What do I do in case it's a function? What value do I return? Well, I'm going to say, well, in this particular case, you shouldn't have done that, but I'm going to go ahead and return a default value for you, and it's going to be a value of 0 interpreted as an integer, which is 0, or as a Boolean, which is false, or as a char, which is the character having the 0 code, and I think that's the null character in the ASCII character set. Why 0? Well, 0 is a pretty good initial value, and if you made an error sort, so it was going to return a value, but since you didn't return a proper value, you're going to get a default that we choose. If you want to return, excuse me, my voice is starting. So if you want to return the proper value, put the proper return in. So in this case, we're doing something to avoid early termination. And finally, here's another case where we have an opportunity to do a little bit of optimization. So we have to determine how much of a stack depth we have to allow. So I'm going to show you the easy way that I chose, which is almost certainly guaranteed to be too big, but in some cases might actually be too small. But this is allowed, and if you go ahead and do this, the TA will not punish you in any way. So we're guessing 25, nice round number. Seems pretty big to me. It's probably way too big. And that means that if I ever tried to push 26 or more parameters on the stack, 26 or more anything, I'd have an error. So in this particular case, you can make a little note, opportunity for extra credit. Here's a simple way to get extra credit. Namely, one way to blow that limit is to have a method that actually has more than 25 parameters. How can you tell that? Well, notice as you're processing the parameters, you could keep a track of, okay, how many parameters did this guy have? If it's more than 25, you update a counter beyond 25 to the maximum. So if I happen to have something that had 26 parameters, because it had 26 letters maybe, I would record that and I would say, if the maximum parameter count is greater than 25, use it. If it's less than 25, we'll go ahead and use 25 just as a way of guaranteeing, or close to guaranteeing, we don't overflow the stack. If you want more extra credit, here's a way to do it right. And this you might want to pay attention to, because this also appears on exam questions and old exams, and who knows if it might appear on the new exam. I haven't written it yet, but it's certainly a possibility. And that's a question of, if I wanted to do this right, how hard is it and what do I need to do? Well, it turns out what you need to do is something called abstract interpretation. And what abstract interpretation says is, assuming I get it on the screen, is that I can actually analyze code not for what it directly does, like compute a value, but for some properties it has. So we're going to have a couple of insights. One of them is the actual operand stack will always return to zero at the end of any single statement. Now, can anybody tell me why that's probably got to be the case? That means that stack can go get deep and shrink, deep and shrink. But at the end of statement, maybe a simple one like A gets 1, or a complex one like F gets, call F of 1, 2, 3, blah, blah, blah. So in that particular case, why would it have to be at the end of that statement? The stack goes back to zero. And the answer is, assume it didn't. Here's the nasty statement. It ends up leaving the stack with extra stuff sitting on it. What I do is I just write a while loop around it and let that while loop run a lot of times, maybe a million, maybe a billion, maybe a trillion. What comes after trillion? People say gazillion, but that's not a real number. Well, what comes after trillion? Billion, trillion, quadrillion, quintrillion. What's next? Sept, I guess. Quint is five, so sextillion, then sept would be seven, octillion. I think at that point you just yeah, that's right, you go to backs. So anyway, here's, so if it were the case that a statement were ever allowed legally to leave something non-empty on the stack, if I ever wrote that statement around the loop, my program would be guaranteed to fail. But it's a valid program, and valid programs should not fail. So the takeaway, number one, is any statement has to return the stack to zero. So all we need to do to get the correct number, rather than 25, is for each and every statement I translate to track how deep the stack ever goes. That's where this abstract interpretation comes in. And here's what we would do. Every time you generate an instruction, we do it just to have the effect of push or pop or whatever. But each instruction has the effect of pushing or popping the stack, or maybe leaving it alone by a certain amount. So if, for example, I do a load constant of 22, what's the effect on the stack of a load constant? It increases by 1, so I'll have a little notion of plus 1. If I have some kind of store, like iStore, that takes something off the stack and stores it into memory. So what's the net effect on the stack? Minus 1. If I do an iAdd, It takes two operands off the stack and pushes the sum on the stack. So what's the net effect? Minus one. And you can do that for all the instructions you have there. And what you would do is, as you track the code being generated for a single statement, you would say, what's the maximum depth they ever get? By the way, this is also good for checking errors in your code generation, because if this number ever goes negative, that means you're trying to pop more guys from the stack that ever got pushed. And believe me, the Java runtime system does not like that. As soon as that happens, it calls an error and terminates you. So this is a way also of catching that error. So what you would have to do then is, on a statement-by-statement basis, as you generate code instructions, say, okay, I just generated an LDC. Let's also update the stack depth. Some will increase the depth, others will decrease the depth. Okay, so why is that at all trivial? It looks pretty easy. Sometimes I add one, sometimes I subtract one. Excuse me? You have to do it every instruction, but only within a statement. So notice what happened. Each time you start a new statement, remember you have an AST node called statement, don't you? Yeah. Or statements.
What I was saying is every instruction.
Right. Right, of ones we use. Right, so I mean, you know, and that's why it's worth some extra credit. And particularly noticing calls, what would happen there is you'd have to look at the actual signature on the call and say, how many parameters did it have? Again, since you generated, you could probably go ahead and actually track that. If you wanted to, you'd say, well, this guy had this signature. Oh, by the way, he had 25 parameters or 10 parameters or whatever, and just have it. But for an invoke static, you'd have to say, okay, took as many parameters as it had, popped those off, and then if it returned a value, it leaves one value on the stack. If it didn't return a value, it leaves the stack empty with respect to all the parameters you had. So that's there. And the question is, why in the world do we ever need to do that? Could anybody ever write a program other than one that had more than 25 parameters that actually blew the limit? And the answer is actually, yes, there is. And it's one that people use sometimes for testing other aspects of compiler. And let me say, let's do a simpler one first. If I say, so A to Z, how many stack locations would you imagine this guy's going to use? And the good news is not very many. Just remember the code you generated is, it says push A, push B, do an add. Push C and do an add. Push D and do an add. So even though this thing has 26 operands, it's going to go ahead, in this case, it's only going to take two locations. Because as you generate the code, you're going to see load A pushes the stack to 1. Load B pushes the stack to 2. Do the add, reduces the stack back to 1. Push C back to 2, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1. Finally, when you get all done, it's going to leave 1 on the stack. That 1 then is going to be stored, and that's going to end up being 0. So, hey, that's good. That means complex expressions do not blow your stack. That's if you have a friend writing code. If, for example, I had somebody putting parens in, yeah, I heard a groan, and that's rightly so. I could write it this way. And sometimes this is valid, other times not so. All this is doing is forcing the addition to go right to left. Now, but why is that bad? Now it's push, 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 all the way up to 26. And then I start doing the I add, reducing the stack down. So one way to blow the 25 limit is to do this thing with A through Z with 26 operands in the addition, parenthesized to force a right to left rather than left to right addition. Again, I can't imagine any sane person doing it, but I could imagine a nasty TA. Now, you wouldn't do it in this case because we're not requiring it, but if you claim that you were able to accurately get the numbers, he might try that. Just a word of warning. So let's go back and... So now what happens here... Okay, we're back with a help, a little help from the audience here. That's good. I've been meaning to try this anyway in a situation, you know, like lounge singers, right? You know, I could move around and just, and if it worked, and I don't know if it, it probably does. It does. So as I was saying, what you do here is you almost certainly will just generate 25. Again, if you want a little bit of extra credit, just count the maximum number of parameters any method has. It's really not that hard because you're kind of doing that as you're generating the type code anyway. So in a sense, what you do is you take the number of parameters in the letters in the type code, pull out all the left brackets, and just do the A, you know, just do the I's and the C's and the Z's and all that, and just count the number of letters, and that will give you the number of parameters. So it's really not a bad computation at all. So either 25 or 25 plus, or the max of 25 and that, or this abstract interpretation, where you look at the code generated, determine for each statement how many stack locations that statement has, and gather the max across all statements. What we then also have is something that's nicely easier, namely we also have to say how many locals we have in our method. That's so that when the frame is created, they have enough slots in the frame for each local variable, including parameters. The way parameters are handled is parameter, the first parameter is given number 0, the second parameter number 1, etc. And when all the parameters are handled, locals then start with the next available number. So in this particular case, the number of locals we counted in this particular case is also the number of slots we need because we counted them, and we have that available, and away we go. And then you just generate end method, and that's the end of the definition of the method. So any questions on that? Again, a lot of details, but most of it is just boilerplate that you fall into place with. Let's go ahead and we're going to redo varidecals, because previously varidecals didn't know about methods and didn't know about this business about allocating space for the methods. So what's going to change here is right in this section here. Previously, we just had to worry about varidecals. If the current method is null, it's global. Otherwise, it's local. And in the case of locals, what we have to do is allocate an index, make sure it's marked as local, and increment the number of locals you use. And then if there's any initialization, generate code for the initialization. So the new stuff here is essentially just saying, it's a local. How do I know it's a local? Well, you know it's a local because up here, the current method is non-null. That means I'm pointing to a method, which means I'm inside of a method. It might be I'm doing a parameter, or it might be that I'm doing a local, but they're all treated the same. So in this particular case, the addressing info says I'm a local as compared with a global. And whatever the size is, that's my current offset and increase the size by 1. So size starts at 0, and therefore the first parameter gets 0 as its offset. The next one gets 1, 2, etc. And every time you see one, you increment, so your count is correct. And the initialization is the same sort of initialization we saw previously. So this should work fine. For a local constant declaration, you do much the same thing if it's a local. The only difference is there must be an initializer, so you go ahead and compute the initializer and do a store. And for an array, you go ahead and you allocate a slot for the array, but now you have to go down here and generate some code. So you push the size of the array, and in this particular case, you allocate the array, and then you store the reference that's created back into the frame using the local reference you happen to have. So that doesn't change very much. And finally, block nodes. Hey, look, blocks are remarkably simple. They have variables and have statements, but the code generation doesn't change at all from what we did previously. All that means is blocks allow you to intermix local declarations and other statements. But no matter where they are, declarations are handled like they are, and statements just as we showed before. So if I have some locals in the middle of a method, that simply increases the offset and gives some additional slots in the frame for those newly declared variables, but it doesn't matter. If I have a total of 20 declarations in parameters and up at the top of the statements and inside blocks within the statements, I simply say the number of locals is 20 and the actual offsets vary from 0 to 19. So the mere fact that blocks exist doesn't mean they're any more expensive. And that's always a little surprising. It's kind of handy to be able to have, here's a little location where I'll give you a variable for only a limited amount of time. So I should point out that in older compilers where memory was more an issue, they actually tried to recycle slots so that it might be that one local and another could share space. Now you don't worry about that as much as you used to because we have so much space in terms of gigabytes here and gigabytes there and gigabytes everywhere that the reuse doesn't really seem worth the effort anymore. But if it struck you that they could be recycled and you're sort of a green person, that is a possibility. So I think that's all I had to say about code generation. Now, I know I went through that a little fast, but I went through it a little fast because a lot of it is detailed in the notes, so no reason for me to go character by character. Just kind of get the big picture. And any questions about that, about what haven't I included, by the way? There's been a couple of things there that I didn't include. What were they and how important are they? Remember, I had a method call in a statement, and I also had a function call. But if you think about it, that's virtually identical. The only difference is the function is going to leave something on top of the stack. So that is not going to change much at all. What else didn't I include? Must have been something. Well, we had binary app nodes. What didn't I include? Unary app nodes. And how many unary apps do we have? One. So you're in for that. That means you're going to have to figure out how to do a knot. And you smile, but it's not as necessarily as trivial as you think. So that means you're going to have to turn a 0 into a 1 and a 1 into 0. And there is, in fact, a way of doing that. Think about it, and if you still have questions, you can ask me or put it on Piazza or something. Is there anything else I haven't included? I think we're pretty much there. If there isn't, it can't be very major. So anyway, the code generation notes are in place, and that, I think, will be a help. So we have one last topic I want to get to, and that's garbage collection, because this is one of those magic things that gets included in more and more languages. And I always hate when something in computer science is magic. There's a famous saying by Arthur C. Clarke. I may have mentioned this in an earlier lecture, so I'd love to say it. But it's any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. It's a great line because in computing, it's absolutely true. We are computer professionals in one way or the other. And for us, it ought not to be magic. We ought to know what's sort of behind the screens. And garbage collection is something that more and more languages rely upon. Why? Well, memory management is done by programmers is very, very dicey. It's a situation where you've got to get it just right. If you're doing memory management, what that means is you do calls to new or malloc or whatever it happens to be, says, give me some memory, give me some more. And then at some point, you give memory back. Well, it turns out if you keep asking for memory and never giving it back, you have a condition called memory leaks. It's really kind of memory bloat, but memory leaks is the term people use. And you may have seen that. That's a case where as a program runs longer and longer, it has to, at some stage, it gets bigger and bigger in terms of its memory requirement. And at some stage, it runs out of memory and has to be stopped. In fact, it turns out funny that about this because one of our professors, Professor Bart Miller, is a pilot. He's got a pilot's license. And at one stage, he took his students to a smaller local airport. And they were going to the control tower. And they could see the things there, you know, and say, you know, you get to go on the phone, you know, American flight 777, or just 666, coming in for an entry, you know, take, you know, runway 18 south or 18 west or whatever it is, and away you go. Well, the guy doing the demo was really impressed that he had a computer science prof there. And they were talking about all the software he has. And it turned out the software actually had a code bloat problem. Namely, it had a memory leak, and it got bigger and bigger and bigger. And you could probably imagine what happens as planes come in and that they were dynamically allocating memory for it, but they weren't always releasing it properly. So the amount of memory holding flights got bigger and bigger. So Bart naturally asked him, well, what do you do, you know, when you hit a limit? And he says, oh, we just wait until we have a quiet time in the airport and we just shut the thing down and reboot it. Now, that would work in a little airport, but suppose many of you get to fly through Chicago, O'Hare. What would you be comfortable? You know, you're flying in the middle of the night and the control tower says, please take a timeout for 10 minutes. We're going to reboot our computer. It just ran out of memory. So it turns out trusting people to do memory management properly is kind of dangerous. So what I wanted to talk about then is, let's go back to our notes, is how we can automate the process and do it right
and do it effectively.
So we actually talked about this a little bit last time, a couple of weeks ago, but it's something where I think we ought to get back to some detail. One of the oldest ways of tracking memory. Now, all we want to do here is we want to track as you allocate a memory location or a memory block. So in terms of Java, think of it as all the objects that have been acquired via new. At some stage, you don't need that memory anymore, and you'd like to return it. But you want to make sure that you don't return something that's in use, and you do return things that are no longer in use. What does no longer in use mean? Well, we have to figure that out, and we have to do it very precisely, because if we mess up and we think something is in use, is not in use and is, we could be in trouble. Think of that airport control system. There's, you know, your plane's coming in and the program makes a mistake and says, oh no, that's garbage, let's throw it away. And all of a sudden, all the info about your plane disappears. Maybe you go off the radar screen. Because after all, your radar screen these days isn't really a radar screen. It's a computer visualization of what information they have of what's in the area. And if that entry goes away, it may blank out. And that's not a very comforting sort of feeling, that you've effectively disappeared from the controller's point of view. So we don't want that to happen. So one of the earliest ways was essentially said, when we allocate memory from the heap, we'll add a little integer field, initially one, that says how many guys are pointing. What do you mean by guys? How many references exist to this object? And the notion is, as long as that count is non-zero, it's initialized to one, because when you do a new, you assign the new to somebody and they get one. But what might happen is that as, so you go ahead and say P gets new int array of size 10, for example, something like that. So P points to this array, so elements 0 through 9, and here's this little count. So the count is initially 1, because when I create that, I assign it to somebody. And it says Q gets P. So now my count gets updated to 2, as I took an existing object and increased a reference to it, hence reference counting. If at some stage I say Q gets null, 2 goes down to 1. And if eventually I say P gets null, it goes down to 0. And as soon as a reference count goes to 0, nobody can point to it. Nobody can point to it. You can successfully remove the data. Notice you got to be very careful here, because there are some cases where, for example, a variable may go out of scope. You may have had a local pointer and you left the scope. That's the same thing as saying that that particular pointer goes to null, because it can no longer be used. So you have to take that into account. If you're doing bookkeeping, you have to do careful bookkeeping. But it's one of the oldest ideas around. It also has the disadvantage, it costs you a little bit of overhead each time you do a pointer operation. You pass a pointer, you copy a pointer, you overwrite a pointer, etc. You have to take the reference count into effect. There's also an issue, which I don't know how big an issue it is, but reference counting does not work for circular objects. Circular objects, like remember 367, there was a circular list, where essentially you could keep going around the data structure as often as you wanted. And the problem is internal pointers and external pointers are not distinguished. So notice in this case, the top guy has a count of 2. All that means is how many arrows are pointing to him. But in this case, if I kill the global pointer, the count goes down to 1, but there are no longer any external pointers to this guy, and therefore he's inaccessible. But there's no way for me to establish that. Some systems say, well, we'll simply accept that and perhaps do a different garbage collector for those sort of objects. Other people have worked on fancier things. They track external, internal pointers and all that. I don't want to bore you with that, but that's an issue that does exist. One of the oldest garbage collection techniques, and believe it or not, this goes all the way back to the 1960s. Some of the very earliest programming languages actually needed garbage collection. It turns out these were not the Fortran type programs, the assembler programs, but there were other much more dynamic languages. Some of you may have heard of things called Lisp or Scheme or so on. And some of the very earliest languages actually had a requirement for garbage collection because they recognized early on that you could not, in most interesting programs, bound the number of objects that might be created. Therefore, you needed something to dynamically create them. But again, in those days, computers had very limited memory. We're talking many computers had less than a megabyte of memory. Not a gigabyte, a megabyte. So reclaiming memory effectively was very important. So essentially what Mark and Sweep did, let me show you a picture I think is easier. Yeah, there we go. Is that we track all the pointers that can possibly exist in a program. How do we do that? Well, we keep track of all the global variables that can be pointers. This works effectively when you have a language that has pointers as a distinct type from other things. Java, for example. That's one of the reasons why Java distinguishes references from integers. You can never change an integer into a reference or back again because they're distinct. So what you do is you keep track of all the global references or pointers. Inside frames that are sitting on the stack, you have a little layout that says here and here and here are the references that exist inside this frame. Each frame has a number. Each number has a correspondence as well. You're the frame that belongs to method M or method P or method Q. And it may be that an object has a reference to another object so they can link together. So here, for example, is a situation where you want to do mark sweep garbage collection. And what happens is you traverse all the pointers, starting at the globals, then starting at locals, and then internal pointers, and mark those guys that are alive. So object one is alive because there's a global pointer to it. Object three is alive because of that. And object five is alive because three is alive and it has a pointer to something else. So you have to follow pointers and mark them. So all the guys that are not kind of shaded out are considered live. Conversely, anything that's not shaded out is considered garbage. So in this particular case, I'm able to determine that the what would have been object two, it doesn't have a name anymore, and object four can be returned to the free space list. Nobody ever cares about them, so those guys could be reincarnated as brand new objects at some point allocation. So by being able to do this, I'm able to, in this case, distinguish between live and non-live data, and I do it automatically so that in this particular case, it's unlikely to have human error involved. Oh, you don't. You don't. It's just a matter that it's expensive. And it turns out that in some cases, well, I haven't talked about one of the dangers of this yet, but you don't have to. But it's mostly a situation there is that why do people wait until a couple of days before an exam before studying for it? Well, in a situation, who knows what might happen, right? I guess what I'm wondering is, could you not run this in parallel? Well, yes and no. Here's the problem. In fact, let me get to it because you kind of stole a little bit of my thunder. Situation is that this sort of technique works out nicely, but can you use it while a program is running? Because remember, as a program is running, it's creating garbage and creating new links and all that, and do they step on each other's toes? So some of the oldest techniques, what they did is, in retrospect, was very dangerous. They actually temporarily stopped the program. Why is that dangerous? Well, many simulation languages actually used languages that require garbage collection. So what you'd have a very fancy thing. You'd have a simulator, like a flight simulator, almost like the games they have, you know, where you pretend you're a pilot in an FA-18 or what's the new one out there, the F-23, is it, or something? Anyway, you know, you've got a joystick, and you're coming along, and somebody's on your tail, and he says, you know, and the little buzzer goes off, you know, somebody's locked you onto his radar, and you do a sharp turn. But guess what? That's just the instant where the garbage collector decides that it's going to collect garbage. So you got the thing saying, turn, 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 and he's doing nothing at all because he's garbage collecting. Then all of a sudden he comes back to life and you start to fly again. In fact, if you had, in the old days, if you had computer games that had this property that sometimes they would hang up or go sluggish, oftentimes it was a garbage collection issue of it trying to reclaim space. So that's a danger, and it turns out that in real airplanes, of course, flight control is all by computer. These days, I mean, it used to be the notion that a pilot flies a plane. That's not really true at all. A computer flies the plane, and the pilot kind of gives a hint of what they want. In fact, it's not widely understood, but most modern jet fighters, at least certainly the ones the U.S. has, are inherently unstable. That means if you turned off the computer flight control, the thing would start to tumble immediately. It's not like the old Piper Cubs and anything, which if you ever took flight lessons on the early ones, you can actually let go of the controls, and the thing is nice and straight and it keeps on going. So why would you imagine combat planes would be inherently unstable? Well, if somebody's shooting at you, being unstable is a pretty cool idea, isn't it? In the situation there, you know, you just let the controls go and all of a sudden you start zipping. If somebody's shooting at you or whatever, you're unlikely to be where he thought you were going to be, and therefore you're likely to continue flying for a while. But at any rate, you know, situation, computer controls are tied in, and the notion is what can you do to go ahead and control what's going on? Well, it turns out there are other techniques which are a little bit better when it comes to doing concurrency, but you can, in fact, try to have a notion of what objects are currently referenced and which ones aren't, and have them coordinate every now and again. So we're not talking about concurrent garbage collection, which is difficult. There is in the textbook a section written by actually somebody who did some research on it about various notions people have had for concurrent garbage collection. The claim is there are not only concurrent garbage collection, but there are multi-process garbage collectors. You're able to write a program that has not just one process running, but two or three or four or many. As you might imagine, most airplanes have multiple processes. One is controlling the attitude of the plane. Another one is perhaps controlling the radar. Another one might be doing communications. Another one might be doing weapons targeting, et cetera. Each one of those is generating garbage on a separate parallel tack and a garbage collector or two, and they're all garbage collecting, and even that's possible. It's really complex stuff, but it's been researched. So in this particular case, let's just assume that when you do garbage collection, you stop the program from allocating or changing references to make life simple. So now it's possible to sweep through memory. Question is, how fast is that going to be? Find all the objects that are alive, mark them. That's the marking. And then we sweep through, and anything that's not marked is grabbed as garbage and recycled, reused. And notice that it's important in this particular case that we find all pointers. That's why languages that don't distinguish between pointers and non-pointers, like C, are difficult to garbage collect. But actually, it turns out there's a way of doing that, and it's sort of amazing how clever people can be when they're forced to be. So that means if it was possible for me to take an integer and change it into a pointer, or take a pointer and change it into an integer, the garbage collector would be in deep trouble. You say, hey, I thought that happened to be, it was the integer 1234, and it was really a pointer 1234, which should have affected garbage collection. So languages like C and C++ that allow casting between pointers and non-pointers are problematic. That's why for a long time they did not have garbage collectors. That's why you had manually free up space. Maybe you know you have some applications here where you have to free space manually because there's no garbage collector to protect you. And you do that very carefully for fear of missing something and making something garbage that isn't garbage. And here's that's talking about that we worried about C and C++. We'll talk about it later, but what they do actually do is conservative garbage collection. And that allows you to do some garbage collection and still not make the errors that you might fear. So all heap objects must be swept. Notice that this is expensive if most objects go to garbage quickly. It's one of the open questions. Why would you need garbage collection? If very few things ever went to garbage, you don't need garbage collection. That's like one of these situations here. If you buy something and hold on to it forever and ever and ever, you may know somebody, you know, who has an old car that's 20 or 30 years old and say, well, why don't you get a cooler car, a new car, you know, something that doesn't have an 8-track in it or whatever it might be. Well, it's still running and I've got my money out of it and it's all found money and all that. So on the other hand, people like to change, or other people like to lease cars and get a new car every, what is it, at least 3 years or something, get a new car each lease period. So it turns out that if objects turn to garbage very quickly, that is, they need to be recycled quickly, then obviously you need to do garbage collection often. If things don't go to garbage very often, you don't need garbage collection very often. You may not need it at all. You can imagine Java programs where you allocate a complex data structure early on, and then it never changes. There, you don't really need garbage collection. Many programs are a mixture. But it's going to turn out some of the actual garbage collectors we're going to have actually are proportional not to the amount of garbage, as this guy is, but it's actually proportional to the number of live objects. That means if lots of things go to garbage quickly, that's good. I can make things faster. So all I'll do is pay attention to live objects. And the way you do that is we simply have the guys who are live identify themselves, and everything else will automatically turn to garbage like that. It's kind of a cool idea, but it's something that can happen. Another issue we had with mark and sweep, let's go back a moment, is that notice we had two holes, numbers 2 and number 4, but they're not physically adjacent. And it might be the case that I need allocation for a big data object, and neither 2 nor 4 are big enough by themselves. And I can't, as it stands, use them simultaneously because they're not contiguous. So that being the case, many garbage collectors add in a phase called compaction, which will actually take the garbage, move it to one end of memory, take the live objects, move them to the other end of memory, and by putting all the garbage contiguously, change little pieces into a much bigger piece that's more convenient for allocation. And that's called compaction. Some techniques make compaction easier, others make it a little harder. So if you're doing it in mark sweep, after we allocated all the live objects, we'd figure out where we're going to move the garbage, and live objects would move, and their references would change. Here's another example of why it's dangerous to do that while a program's running. Trying to change a value that a program's using in the middle of being used is real dangerous. Okay. So let's take another little break, and what time is it? So it's 7:40. Let's do 7:50, and we probably have a little less than 20 minutes or 30 minutes of time. We have about 15 slides left. So we'll get through those, and we'll be out of here. So see you in about 10 minutes.